Hey everyone, it's Pat Gray here. I'm sorry to have done this, but I actually had to nuke the original episode 590 of Risky Business and push this recut version as a new podcast into your feed. It turns out that our analysis of the Palo Alto vulnerability that has everyone pretty worried right now, we spoke about that yesterday, and that analysis was in fact off. We were operating with limited information like everyone else. In addition, we were given some incorrect information, and then we made some assumptions, a bunch of assumptions that were in fact wrong. Anyway, we'll be back next week with a full post-mortem and some better analysis on that bug. And in the meantime, patch your Palo Alto devices because there is a serious authentication bug in them when you're using SAML, which you are if you're using a third-party identity provider to auth to them. We initially thought the Validate Identity Provider Certificate checkbox factors into all of this, and it doesn't. So you're fine to leave that checkbox unticked. Apologies for our mistake, and here is the recut. Enjoy. Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. Adam Boileau will be along in just a minute to talk through all the week's security news, and then it will be on to this week's sponsor interview. And this week we are chatting with Mark Rogers of Okta. Mark is the VP of Security Strategy over there at Okta, and they are, of course, the identity giant. They are one of the few sponsors we actually approached last year for the 2020 season because, you know, they're very good at what they do. And this week, Mark will be joining us to talk through some privacy-related issues, actually. The discussion is nuanced, but basically we'll be looking at how the public perception of privacy risks, digital privacy risks, has diverged from the reality, but also about how the COVID crisis and the advent of digital contact tracing apps have actually brought general concerns around digital privacy to the fore. That is an interesting conversation, and it is coming up after this week's news segment with Adam Boileau, which starts now. And Adam, we're going to do something a little bit differently this week because, unlike most weeks, our run sheet and this week's newsletter are basically a one-to-one match. So we're essentially working through Brett's newsletter this week. But look, he started off with some analysis of this new bill that's been proposed in the United States. It's called the Lawful Access to Encrypted Data Act of 2020. We don't think it has a guaranteed chance of passing, let's put it that way. But yeah, we have had a look at the bill text, and you know, this is what we'd call the big one. This is the worst case bill that privacy advocates have been worried about.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty blunt, right? You can certainly see what they're trying to do here, which is just pry open some of the controls that the tech community has been, you know, spent so many years now building. There isn't a lot of wiggle room. You know, some of the other jurisdictions have had some restrictions. The Australian one, for example, you know, had some provisions kind of saying what the expectations were of where controls could be weakened and in what circumstances, that kind of thing, and for what levels of, of crime being investigated, these kinds of things would apply. Whereas this just seems, you know, pretty, in a way, typically American, kind of blunt, you know, just make it work, nerds.
Yeah, we called it the Nike approach, just do it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. A line that I managed to sneak into the newsletter.
But yeah, I mean, you know, you get the impression that they're just not messing around, right? And obviously it has to become law before we start to really worry, but I mean, it looks like a pretty big deal.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. And this is a Republican bill with three Republicans attached to it, and I can't see the Democrats jumping on board with something this heavy-handed. So we got to wait till November to really see what's going to happen. But look, if the Republicans can flip Congress, hang on to the Senate, and Trump gets in again, I mean, this could become law, right? And that would be bad.
I mean, it would be amongst many bad things, but yes, it would be bad. And it's a thing we have to consider a possibility, unfortunately. And, you know, it's one thing where, you know, countries like the UK and Australia, you know, pass laws that affect their local populace. But, you know, for us being, you know, in the American-centric world, it has impact for all of us, right? I mean, in the West, when America goes ahead and does something like this, if they end up doing it. So, you know, it's not a thing that even outside the borders, we can just pretend that isn't going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, right, that the crypto debate has taken this long for it to actually arrive at that point where here's the big Kalia for mobile phone apps bill. And it's funny too, because like a few people have commented that it is essentially Kalia for mobile apps, but they, instead of just amending Kalia, they're doing like a whole new bill. Like there's some weird stuff here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is kind of the consequence of breaking network interception and taking away a bunch of the other tools. You know, now they're just going to say, well, you have to do it at the edge of the network, which has always been, you know, the kind of the end game of, you know, you put crypto in the middle, well, we're just going to go to the edge. And that's what they're going to try and do with this.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Moving on, and we got some hilarious research from Trustwave here. I mean, it's not funny, I guess.
But, it's a funny ha-ha, but I mean.
Walk us through it.
So a couple of Western companies operating in China were required to install some software by their local bank to deal with some tax stuff. Trustwave got involved with this after it turned out that the software in question downloaded a backdoor at some point many hours after installation and was providing, you know, remote privileged access to some third party unrelated to the tax, maybe unrelated to the tax software vendor in question. This does not look good.
No, and the client in question is, quote, a UK technology company that serves US, UK and Australian defence agencies. Yeah, so.
Dear, oh dear. Yeah, you can kind of see how those dots line up. And I guess, you know, the questions people are asking are, you know, is this the tax company? Is this the Chinese government ordering the tax company to backdoor their software? Is it done without the knowledge, you know, of the tax company by the Chinese government? Is it somebody else? We don't know, because this is the, you know, post-attribution world that we live in or something. But, I mean, you got to say, UK defence contractor operating in China mysteriously gets owned by some official software. I mean, you know, the arrows point in a certain direction.
This is the second time I can think of region-specific accounting software getting people in trouble because, you know,
yes, right.
2017, it was NotPetya. That was the initial vector, wasn't it?
Yeah, the accountancy software in Ukraine backdoored, although that was, you know, wasn't the accountancy software firm's fault, given that that one appeared to be the Russians. But hey, maybe this is the Russians too. I don't know.
You never know. It could be the Russians pretending to be the Chinese. You know?
Exactly. Why not?
It could be the North Koreans pretending to be the Russians pretending to be the Chinese. Let's, you know, you just never know. Who is the puppet master? Who is the puppet master? Moving on, and Assange, Julian Assange, has a what we've described as a juicier charge sheet now. He's been hit with a second superseding indictment, and although they haven't expanded the number of charges, they've certainly sort of padded out the indictment with more information, more allegations that sort of indicate a broader pattern of criminal activity.
Yeah, some of these relate to, you know, Assange soliciting or encouraging people to, you know, go out and do hacking and provide documents from that back to WikiLeaks. The corroboration with Sabu from Lulzsec is one of the ones that's been called out in particular. And obviously, you know, he was an FBI snitch at the time. So, you know, presumably they've got some pretty good logs.
Yeah, I mean, asking an FBI snitch to, like, go hack stuff for you generally doesn't end well, right?
Well, I think this is a good example of it not ending well. But yeah, I mean, some of these, I mean, you know, people who've been defending Assange and saying, well, you know, he's kind of a journalist, you know, it's pretty hard to argue with, you know, telling people to go out and, you know, do crimes and give you specific stuff. Like that's a, you know, it's a hard one to defend.
It is, right? And you and I were talking just before we started recording, and like there's plenty of people who will defend his actions on moral grounds, but it's looking increasingly less likely that you can defend him on legal grounds, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the argument that, you know, US Justice Department appears to be making.
Yeah.
That, yeah, he done a crime.
Andy Greenberg, meanwhile, has written an excellent feature up for Wired about DDoS leaks, which, funnily enough, just got suspended from Twitter this week. This is an interesting feature because it's looking at, you know, Emma Best's initiative to try to create like a better version of WikiLeaks. But I just have a feeling that anyone who winds up running a service like this is going to wind up inadvertently laundering documents for intelligence services. They're just too much of a conduit, too useful.
I mean, they are too useful, and DDoS secrets in particular, of course, just handled the, you know, that leak from a bunch of US police fusion centers. That's a, you know, pretty big one. And, you know, in some respects, kind of hard to defend, you know, the value of that versus the cost in terms of, you know, intrusion into people's privacy there is difficult. But then when they've also said specifically that they're totally fine handling stuff that has come from intelligence agencies. And that's one of their criticisms of WikiLeaks, is that WikiLeaks tried to obscure the fact that, you know, for example, the DNC documents came from the Russians, whereas DDoS Secrets are saying, well, you know, the data's the data and we'll just be upfront about where we got it from.
It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. And you know, like, say these blue leaks, right? Say it's an election year, right? Like, everyone's like, why did Twitter pull down this stuff? You've got a leak, a hack and leak site all over Twitter. You know, yeah, 4 months before the US federal election, publishing data that is the hot button issue of the time. I mean, what if in a year from now it turns out that some foreign intelligence service was connected to that Fusion Center hack, right? Like, Twitter would be negligent if they allowed that stuff to spread. So it's, you know, I can kind of understand why they've taken the banhammer to them, to be honest.
Well, I mean, yeah, you can, right? And I mean, even when you know that, I mean, even if you did know it was coming from an intelligence agency, right? I mean, the fact that you're being manipulated to do their work for them, right, to play a part in that puzzle is kind of distasteful. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, I don't know how that sits with people who are, you know, are here for activist reasons to be, you know, kind of actively manipulated. Like, to me, that seems contrary to what you are there for. So,
we also saw, like, a couple of weeks back when we spoke about those domains, those GRU domains that Slowik et al. Uncovered. You know, he connected them to some websites hosting content that was, trying to push some buttons around the BLM movement, right? So, I get it, right? So they've not only have they cancelled the account, but they have actually removed, they've gone through and scrubbed links to DDoS Secrets from Twitter, which is really interesting. I mean, that's heavy-handed, but after 2016, you can kind of understand why they're doing that so close to the election.
And I mean, certainly they faced a lot of criticism for not acting, right? For not dealing with, you know, horrible stuff on the platform and things that, are going to make trouble. And, you know, then they are going to get criticized when they do, right? I mean, it's a tough place for a platform like that to be. And, you know, maybe that's part of the deal for all the advertising dollars or whatever, assuming Twitter makes money. I don't know if they do. But yeah, it's, you know, it must be a hard set of equities to balance, right? Because it just isn't, you know, there aren't good answers.
No, and no one really knows what the answer is here. You know, no one knows. That's the thing. And I see a lot of vitriol directed towards a lot of the, and I've flung plenty of vitriol myself at companies like Cloudflare, right? Because I've got a line. It's a very high threshold before I get shouty, but, you know, I will get shouty. For other people, that threshold is different. But I think once you start getting into mainstream social media platforms, it gets complicated so quickly, you know? And have a few beers. Everyone should have a few beers with someone like Alex Stamos one day and have that conversation, because it's you know, man, it is a rabbit hole. Now, look, speaking of banhammers, India has booted around 59 Chinese-owned consumer apps, including TikTok and WeChat, from app stores in that country.
Yeah, we saw, you know, a flurry of news about, you know, TikTok exfiltrating people's clipboards and that kinds of things. But of course, you know, there's also a bunch of tension going on between India and China, you know, over clashes on their border.
Well, I think Indian and Chinese soldiers clubbing each other to death with spiked chunks of wood, you know, probably has more to do with it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the environment around is tense, and, you know, you kind of get the feeling that, you know, booting out a bunch of apps, especially, you know, TikTok is pretty big in India, you know, that's a thing that kind of sends a political message domestically as well as the kind of international relations aspect of it. And, you know, I don't know that the security kerfuffle about, you know, TikTok exfilling data and stuff is really the reason, which is what you're saying there. Like, it does feel more, you know, I feel like probably for more domestic political consumption than anything else.
Well, hang on, if you're India and you've got mounting border tensions with China to the point where people have been killed, and, you know, do you want everyone running TikTok? Like, they're almost at a war footing, right? So it makes sense to me.
Yeah, and of course the question is, what other Chinese infrastructure, Chinese operations, you know, software services, you know, are we going to see this, you know, happen with them? And, you know, a bunch of mobile apps, you know, TikTok, I guess, is a thing that people will feel the loss of, and perhaps WeChat. But I mean, some of the other things on this list are pretty innocuous, you know, kind of, you know, flashlight apps and stuff.
I remember that study from years ago that found like 90% of Android flashlight apps were malware. It's crazy.
Exactly. You just ban all of those all the time anyway. Yeah. But yeah, it's going to, you know, it'll be interesting to see how this does kind of develop, whether we see this ratchet up into things other than just mobile applications, you know?
But you say that's innocuous. It's still an install footprint on Indian devices, right? And if you're China, you can leverage that. Straight up.
Well, absolutely, right? I mean, any old app is fair game when you can load code onto it and use it to pivot around and into who knows where.
Your flashlight app is, you know, one man's flashlight app is another man's dropper. Let's put it that way.
Exactly.
Look, you just mentioned the TikTok clipboard thing. We got a story here from Ars Technica, which says TikTok and 53 other iOS apps still snoop on your sensitive clipboard data. TikTok actually came out and made a statement along the lines of, this is an anti-spam control, but, you know, we're going to bin it because it's freaking people out. What did you make of all of that?
Well, I mean, it's certainly possible they weren't doing anything particularly evil with the clipboard data, but, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, a lot of data does go through the clipboard and, you know, there's some nuances to how clipboards operate. For example, the way that Apple devices will synchronize the clipboard. So, I mean, if you had your mobile phone running TikTok nearby your desktop and then you're copy-pasting out of your password manager on macOS, that's being propagated over the air into the clipboard on your iPhone and then into TikTok and who knows where. So, I mean, there's a bunch of nuances that make clipboard access more risky than people realize. That's one of the reasons Apple's kind of tightening up on the use of it. You don't really know where that's ending up. So it's certainly possible that that data set was more valuable, you know, to attackers than you would realize. Whether TikTok was doing it on purpose, I don't know. I mean, you know, some of the other apps that that Apple lists as having, you know, been doing this a fair bit, you know, you can understand, and some you really can't. So, you know, maybe people have been using it. Maybe people other than TikTok have been using this, you know, for a thing. I certainly know that, you know, I feel weird, you know, mousing around near, say, a Citrix client or an IDP client, you know, whilst I'm also handling passwords in a clipboard for something else, because, you know, it does get propagated all around the place more than you imagine.
Meanwhile, Google has booted 25 Android apps because they were actually straight up just stealing Facebook credentials. So this is a thing that happens. Oh, and one of them here I see is a flashlight app.
Inevitably, right? Yeah. This was just like straight up popping up a fake Facebook login page when it saw the Facebook app running and just like, you know, putting another browser over the top that looked like the real thing and stealing credits, which, I mean, hey, it's dumb, but it works. And I think there's more than one, looking at the list, there's more than one flashlight app in there. Wallpaper and flashlight apps. Bad idea. Don't use them.
Bad, bad, bad. All right, moving on to some law and order now. And we've spoken a fair bit about Alexei Berkov. There was a lot of, you know, extraditing that guy turned out to be a real hassle, but he's been sentenced now. It looks like he's going to do 9 years.
Yeah, 9 years. This guy was involved in Card Planet, founder of Direct Connection as well. He pled guilty a while ago. And this was the one where, like, the Russians arrested, he was arrested in Israel, going to be extradited. The Russians arrested some Israeli woman to try and do bargaining and then pardoned her, like, the day after he pled guilty. So, yeah, it's
I didn't know that. I did not know that she actually got pardoned. Did she get to go home? Did she?
Yeah, and like shook hands with Vladimir Putin, and Vladimir met the mum, and it was all, Netanyahu was posting, you know, pictures on Twitter of the, you know, happy reunion and stuff. But yeah, this was like literally the day after he pled guilty, because, you know, there's no relationship between these cases.
Sergei Medvedev has also pleaded guilty. This is another Russian man in the United States. He apparently was part of a criminal enterprise that caused more than $568 million in losses, according to CyberScoop.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess they, you know, it takes a while sometimes to round these guys up and you know, get them to justice. But, I mean, it, you know, it's a slow process, but gradually does appear to be working, at least in some cases. So,
yeah,
you know, like hard slog for the US DOJ, but good work.
Now, last week, Adam, of course, we spoke about the big goings-on here in Australia, where the Prime Minister came out and did a big press conference saying we're under attack, et cetera, et cetera. At the time, a few people sort of in the know suggested to me that this might be laying the groundwork for a funding kick to ASD. That has now happened. They're going to get an extra $1.35 billion over the next 10 years. That money is coming out of the defence budget. So, as I said, you know, when Nigel Fair on Facebook was actually saying, well, you know, it's not new budget, I said, yeah, well, you know, it's a couple of less cup holders on the F-35, basically. they want to increase their workforce. They want to have like 500 cyber warriors or something, but it's the usual thing, isn't it? But, you know, the Prime Minister today also just announced a whole bunch of extra defence funding. Like, Australia is drastically ramping up defence spending at the moment, based on everything that's going on with China right now, and yeah, lots of extra bucks for ASD.
Yeah, of course. I mean, this is good news. There's plenty of good work being done at ASD, plenty of smart people, and finding another, what, 500 odd people to hire into that. I mean, that's quite a lot of work. I mean, there's, you know, a lot of talent in the Australian InfoSec market, but 500 people, that's, they're going to be recruiting pretty hard. And of course, they have to work on, you know, retaining all the staff they've got rather than having them, you know, kind of go revolving door back out into the public, into the private sector.
Yeah, we kicked this around in Slack yesterday with Alex Damos and Dmitry Alperovich, which is, you know, it's just great having guys like that in your Slack, I got to say. And yeah, Alex's thought was, you know, you would have to work on retention pretty hard. But Dmitry pointed out that, you know, SIGINT agencies are actually pretty good at training. And, you know, how many, he said, oh, look, it's not going to be as hard as you think, because how many computer science graduates do you get a year? You know, how many of them do you need to divert into some sort of graduate scheme before this becomes viable? And that becomes a bit of a supply pipeline for the private sector as well. So all in all, you know, it looks like probably a good move.
And I mean, certainly necessary. I mean, given the, you know, amount of bad things going on, intrusions happening, and, you know, all the ransomwareing, yeah, they're going to have plenty to keep them busy.
We got one here from Catalan. This is actually, I think, a pretty high impact story. Adobe has EOL'd Magento 1, right? And they're not supporting it anymore. They're not going to patch it anymore. And this is a bit of a problem because there are 110,000 online stores still using it. This is such an issue that Visa and MasterCard have stepped in. And yeah, you take it from here, but this is going to be a shit show.
Yeah, it is. I mean, obviously, you know, Magento's code base goes back quite a long way. It's pretty vintage. Adobe's been, you know, extending its life for quite a long time. But, you know, yesterday, you know, finally, nail in the coffin, end of that. But you look at the rates of install, you know, of Magento 2 platforms, right? And it's still, you know, a third, right? I mean, a quarter, a third maybe of the Magento 1 install base. And yeah, Visa and MasterCard have been waving their sticks around saying, hey, if you are running end-of-life software, you're not going to be PCI DSS compliant eventually. And that could cause you a bunch of problems. But, you know, a lot of these, you know, are little operations, right? And obviously with the COVID situation, you know, there's a lot of quite, you know, small operators, you know, small web shops, you know, that are struggling, right? Aren't in a position to, you know, deal with the changes required to migrate from, you know, Magento 1 to Magento 2, you know, maybe pick up other platforms is where some of the user base is going. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, we've seen Magento really be targeted by, you know, Magecart style operators. And, you know, it's funny that the, you know, people are saying that the supply of Magento bugs has kind of dried up, presumably because they're sitting on them, you know, waiting for EOL to happen so that they can become ever bugs that, you know, yeah, Adobe's never going to deal to.
Well, and the card companies are coming out and saying, well, look, if you keep using this, you're outside of PCI DSS and you're liable for the losses, right? So this could be, yeah, this could be a real disaster in coming months. So definitely happy to flag it here as something we need to pay attention to. Certificates, CA-issued certificates will only be sort of respected for 398 days, Adam.
Yeah, now this is an interesting development. I mean, this is a skirmish that's been going on for a number of years between some of the browser vendors and the certificate authorities at the CAB, the Certificate Authority and Browser, you know, advisory board, where they, you know, hash out how the standards are meant to work. Originally, you know, many years ago, certificates were valid for, you know, 3, 5, sometimes even 8 years. And, you know, obviously there was concern that because the revocation infrastructure is so garbage that, you know, the certificate lifetimes that long was a bad thing for users. And, you know, the browsers have always been pushing for, browser vendors have been pushing for, you know, lower and lower times. What's interesting here is that Apple has come out and said unilaterally that they're going to be valid for a year and change. Google obviously is very keen to jump on the same bandwagon. Mozilla is going to as well. And the CAs are just going to have to suck it up. And that's kind of a breakdown of the, you know, normal, more sort of collegial relationship between, you know, these two parties. And it's very clear that the CAs are, you know, the small fish in that pond now.
Well, ultimately, it's the browser makers who get to decide, right? And this is just proof of that.
Yeah, exactly. But it's also interesting because, you know, browsers and web servers are, you know, the biggest user of the PKI ecosystem, but there are so many others, right? And that the example of the Palo Alto bug and, you know, using certificates to sign, you know, using publicly rooted certificates to sign, you know, identity validation in Federated Auth, for example, or in wireless networks, like those are cases, or software certificates for code signing. Like all of those are really important, but fundamentally edge cases just in terms of scale. And some of these changes, you know, letting the browser vendors just do what they like, ignores the fact that there's so many other users and consumers of certificates and PKI validation, you know, outside of just, you know, the Chromium and WebKit and Mozilla's, you know, cert validation library. And that's where, you know, I think that the previous relationship, more collegial relationship was good because some of those voices were more heard. Whereas now, you know, who knows what's going to happen, you know, with code signing, for example.
Yeah. Yeah, well, hooray. Another one to keep an eye on. Brian Krebs has written an interesting sort of underground economics piece, I guess I'd classify it as.
Yeah, this is a story about how the value of card-present credit card data has gone down in the black market during the COVID because so few people are able to go out and buy stolen product, buy products with stolen cards in stores and then, deal with that kind of physical in-person theft process, whereas the value of card-not-present data has kind of stayed constant. So now there's a real glut because the supply is still very strong. The sorts of, POS skimming and stuff that gets card-present data, those tend to last for quite a long time, have quite a long tail. A lot of those compromises have already happened prior to the COVID slowdown. So yeah, lots of supply, not a whole bunch of demand. So prices are tanking in the black market, unfortunately, if you are in that business.
It's funny, right? Because it's almost like Brian Krebs is like the Wall Street Journal for bad guys. It's a great place.
Yeah.
What have we got here? Someone's going around wiping Lenovo NAS devices and asking for ransoms. Are they actually crypto locking stuff or just wiping it and asking for money?
No, they appear to be just like straight up deleting it and then saying, hey, pay us money to get your stuff back. But there's no evidence that they actually exfil the stuff. So if you get that ransom note, just your data's gone. Give up.
Just bin it. Yeah. And the Evil Corp are apparently now into manually deployed ransomware, asking for millions of US dollars. This is a bit of a worry when you've got a highly capable crew jumping in.
Well, exactly, and especially when we've seen stories about some pretty big organizations paying out, and manually deployed ransomware like this is perfect for really highly targeted attacks.
Yeah, these are the Drydex people, right? And now they're doing ransomware. So, yay, that's going to be great.
Yeah.
We got something called Evil Quest, which is some ransomware targeting Mac OS users. I mean, that's been a market that's been wide open for a while, right? So I'm sort of surprised it hasn't started really happening yet.
Yeah, this one seems to be distributed largely by pirated Mac software. So I guess the moral of the story is maybe don't pirate your Mac software.
A university in California apparently paid a $1.14 million ransomware payment.
Yeah, this is the University of California, San Francisco. They had, I think, part of their medical school ransomware. It was, of course, working on COVID-related stuff. So that's really not great. This one was also interesting because some of the negotiations between the ransomware crew and the university have kind of come out. And you can see the sort of high-pressure sales tactics used by the ransomware crew to try and, get more money out of the university, which is pretty hard reading. But yeah, universities, unfortunately, are just, pretty easy targets for sophisticated operators,
Indeed. Apple Safari 14 is getting WebAuthn, finally. This is going to be rad.
Finally. This is good. I mean, Apple's well positioned to kind of smooth over authentication flows a bit. Hopefully they will do less of a mess of it than some of their other attempts at integrated auth. Having this tied into the new browser, obviously a good thing and kind of part of Apple's work to try and, smooth over some of the rough edges, in privacy and security in Safari.
But this is like WebAuthn right down to the secure enclave, right? For like Face ID and fingerprints and stuff. This is the grail.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing that Apple does well, right? Is integrating vertically, as you say, all the way down to the enclave, making everything work well, be a smooth experience, and really show people, what it's kind of meant to be like instead of the, nasty mishmash of auth tech that we have on other platforms.
Yeah, Catalan had a good story up for ZDNet as well about how Apple declined to implement 16 web APIs in Safari due to privacy concerns. And you think, geez, is that going to break anything? And then you read through the list of the APIs. And not only is this list of APIs proof that browsers are the new operating system, but you think, like, do you really want all that crap in your browser? Stuff like, web USB, web Bluetooth, web MIDI. I mean, web MIDI. Really? We need a web MIDI API?
No, I mean, as you said, this is the problem with turning browsers into the operating system, right? I mean, they inherit all this extra complexity, right? And one of these plugins is the web serial API, so you can drive serial ports, connect your 3D printer or whatever to a web app. And yeah, this is just what happens when you turn the web into the OS. And, whether or not anyone really cares about these things on Mac OS, I don't know. I mean, the number of browsers that implement all of these things, it's pretty much just Chromium. Like, this is largely Google's fault, right?
Totally is.
Wedging all this crazy stuff into the browser. And I mean, Apple's kind of got a point, right? Being able to scan Bluetooth devices in the vicinity from the browser maybe is a thing I don't want.
Yeah, I mean, I'm guessing there's going to be some sort of permission dialogue every time a website wants to start using your Bluetooth, but then you're relying a little bit too much on your users to know exactly what that means, right?
Well, exactly right. And also, you know, the more controls we bodge into the browser, the more we kind of rely on the browser to do everything and do everything well. And it's one of the reasons that, you know, browser plugins and extensions, you know, are such a high risk kind of thing at the moment. Obviously, Chromium's been introducing more controls to limit, you know, what they can do as well. But, you know, people just don't understand what the browser has become when they're making their risk choices, you know.
We're on the home stretch now, but there is another story, again in ZDNet, about a crew that has taken $200 million from cryptocurrency exchanges, which, Adam, sometimes makes me wonder if I would have been better off being a criminal.
Yeah, especially when, you know, this is not super sophisticated, right? I mean, it's straight up, you know, do some recon, identify people who work at the exchange, find their personal mail accounts, fish them there first to build up some kind of context, and onwards to them. And this is stuff that you know, any of our listeners could probably do. And for $200 million, maybe, you know, maybe it would be a bit of line of work.
Now, speaking of getting paid, Sony has finally launched a bug bounty program affecting the PlayStation 4 gaming console, the OS on it, and also the PlayStation Network. And I'm just going to say, it's my feeling that there is gold in them there hills. So get yeah, cracking.
I suspect that there is, because, I mean, this is what the last of the big gaming vendors to add a bug bounty program. They've been running a private one for a while, but actually the bounties are pretty good too, right? So, I mean, there's gold both in terms of bugs and money in these particular hills. I think, what, up to 50K for a PlayStation 4 critical. So, yeah, if you like that platform and you're interested in hacking on some stuff, there's probably some gold indeed.
And finally, Adam, we've linked through to a blog post from a Googler, Lucas Weisselbaum. And this is about Fetch Metadata. Tell us about Fetch Metadata.
So this is an extension to web browsers that adds an extra header in a request, kind of indicating to the server how the request came to be. And the idea of this is that the browser has some context about the origin of a request in terms of, you know, whether it came from, you know, the JavaScript running inside the DOM of a particular site, whether it came from another site, whether it came, you know, from a subdomain, things that when the web server is processing a request are actually quite useful for it to know, you know, for preventing things like cross-site request forgery. So this is a thing that I think Chromium supports. We'll probably see in Firefox as well in the near future. But it allows, yeah, web server operators to add extra controls into their apps to deal with certain classes of cross-site request forgery or other, you know, similar sorts of bugs. I think if you're a web dev or you're a pen tester, web app pen tester, you really do need to understand where this is going. And it's absolutely well worth a read, because it will break your bugs otherwise, pen testers. You know, you don't like that.
Well, Adam, that's actually the end of the week's news. Just a reminder to everyone out there, do go subscribe to our newsletter. Most of the news that we spoke about this week was actually covered in it, and Brett did some excellent analysis. And big thanks also to AutoMox, who do they offer cloud-based patching, which is, you know, quite handy now that everyone's working from home. So do check out AutoMox. And again, thank you to them for sponsoring our fledgling newsletter. It was great to chat to you, my friend. We're going to do it one more time next week, and then we're on break for a couple of weeks, but catch you next week.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news. Okay, this week's show is brought to you by Okta. They do all your web SSO sort of stuff, and you know who they are, because they are a $25 billion company these days. That valuation is kind of new too, because their share price went into hyperdrive this year as Windows networks have been kind of abandoned to gather cobwebs as everyone had to go work from home. So take up in web-based SSO stuff like Okta has just skyrocketed. When COVID set in, people quickly realized the future of identity and authentication looks a lot less like Active Directory and a lot more like Okta. Anyway, this week, Okta's Mark Rogers is joining us. He is the VP of Security Strategy there. But he wanted to join us to talk about a recent survey the company did that looked at people's perceptions around data privacy. Mark says an interesting thing that bubbled up in the survey data was that digital contact tracing apps are driving a bit of anxiety out there when it comes to the general public's understanding of digital privacy issues. This also led to a bit of a discussion about iOS 14, funnily enough. Anyway, here's Mark Rogers.
So the survey wasn't specifically focused on contact tracing. It was focused on data privacy and aspects of data privacy, of which obviously contact tracing is a big one. And probably one of the biggest takeaway that was probably no surprise to a lot of people is that actually contact tracing has led to a much greater awareness of data privacy. If you talk to people before the pandemic, like we did this survey beforehand, and we've repeated it again during the pandemic, you'll find that there's been a significant increase in awareness of contact tracing and its implications. And as a consequence, data privacy and its implications. So people are aware now that phones can be used to track them, and people are more aware of the kinds of data that can be used to track them. But on the flip side, it showed that there is still a fundamental misunderstanding about the implications, which companies are specifically collecting data, and what they're doing with that data. And so, for example, in the respondents about from America, when you ask them what they think social media companies are collecting, you find they say that they don't believe social media companies are collecting things like offline conversations, media consumption, purchase history, who they engage with, that kind of stuff. Stuff which to you and I is kind of obvious that that's the easy stuff. That's the low-hanging fruit that they automatically have access to.
You said offline conversations, though. What did you mean by that?
So like private messages.
Oh, like DMs and things like that, right?
DMs, okay, et cetera, yeah. And messaging through other channels.
I tell you the funniest one that's happened to me recently is I don't know if you've followed it, but there was some research out of a university in Melbourne that suggested that a chemical commonly used in agriculture might have some efficacy in treating COVID-19. It doesn't look like it's panned out that well, or I don't know, it's still being studied. But you know, there was one night where I Googled it for a bit, and because it's used in it's ivermectin, and because it's used in agriculture, the next thing you know, I'm getting ads for tractors for the next 2 weeks. Uh-huh. Right? Like it's funny when that happens.
Yeah, I've got a similar story. So at the moment, I'm being bombarded with adverts for Persian food because I've been doing a bunch of research into
Iranian APTs. Yeah.
I think it's the most hilarious crossover ever from like Iranian APTs into Persian food.
Now I'm hungry. But anyway, go on.
But it just shows that, you know, people
let me summarize what you're saying, right? It seems like people are kind of freaking out over contact tracing when really their understanding of how much they're being tracked already isn't really sufficient.
Yeah, yeah. I would say that's fair. And also that, you know, their understanding of what makes up your online identity is kind of broken as well still. You know, when you ask people what are sensitive components that can be used to identify them, everyone will agree that usernames and passwords are clearly important things, but people don't think that things like music playlists or listened to or videos watched and work done online can be used to profile them.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not a really safe perspective to have.
No, and it's crazy, right? Because I even feel like my understanding of this is behind, because there a certain point came where it all got a bit subtle and sophisticated and weird, and all of these internet giants could start inferring things about you that you just did not realize they could, right? And I do not know, as someone who spent 20 years reporting on InfoSec, I can't really tell you all the ways in which I'm tracked, right? Like I don't even know. I've lost insight into that.
No, I mean, the harsh reality is simply walking out of the house with your smartphone, you are making privacy trade-offs, because the moment you engage with any other kind of outside network, you are giving information. Everything has a data exhaust. IoT devices have data exhaust. Your smartphone has a massive data exhaust. All your apps have data exhaust. And while people kind of get a sharp focus on the things that they get told about, so, you know, COVID-19 has brought into sharp focus the idea that people can collect information about the devices your device interacts with, and that can be used to track you. What people don't realize is those interactions have been going on for years. Mm. In fact, if you dig into the marketing industry, you'll find that there have been all sorts of marketing gimmicks built by sales organizations to track people inside shops that are way more sophisticated than these apps that are quickly being thrown together to track COVID.
Well, I mean, that's kind of how we wound up with, you know, a decent spec for Bluetooth low energy, right? Which is how we wound up with rotating MAC addresses and stuff, was to foil a lot of that tracking technology. There is something deeply ironic, because we are going to talk a bit about contact tracing now and digital contact tracing. There's a huge irony I've found in this whole thing that Apple and Google have put all of this effort into making a privacy-preserving exposure notification API that will not give health authorities a social graph. right? It will give them, it can give them phone numbers if the user opts in at time of registration to give their phone number and allow their details to be passed on to health authorities. That is something you can do with the Apple and Google API, but it will not give a social graph, which has led some countries like Singapore to say, oh, well, we're not going to use it because we want a social graph. It's crazy, right? Like, yeah. But I guess the ironic thing is, you know, Apple and Google have put in all this work and it's seen by average people who aren't necessarily, you know, technology people. Digital contact tracing is seen as the current boogeyman, right? It's just weird how that's all worked out.
And I think it's not unfair. If you consider some other new technologies, I said new, things that have emerged into the public domain, like, for example, genetic fingerprinting. Genetic fingerprinting is now widely accessible. You can just send off a kit, look into your ancestry. And I know quite a lot of people have done that. But now we're starting to hear about things like arrests being made because the data sources, the data pools that are being generated from these things are accessible and are being used for law enforcement purposes.
I mean, there's one case where we can think of that where it was used to track down a historical serial killer. So when people use that as an example of privacy gone off the rails, I kind of think they should pick a better example.
I don't think of that as privacy gone off the rails, but I do think of that as privacy brought into the limelight.
Yes, yes, so, I see. Yeah, I agree 100%. Know, yeah,
it made front page on all of the papers, and it was on all of the major mainstream media. And so if you go and ask people about it, people are very aware of it. And it's the same is true about COVID-19 and contact tracing. If you rolled the clock back and went a couple of years ago and started asking people about contact tracing, people wouldn't have a clue. And they wouldn't have a clue about what could be done with the smartphones. But it's been brought into sharp focus. And so now people have got opinions about that specific aspect of it. The problem is the genie is kind of out of the bottle already. And so we're looking to try and, deal with something that's already out there. And at the same time, we're ignoring other things that are potentially just as problematic.
No, this is like,
but they just haven't been brought into focus.
Yeah. Yet. Yeah. What you're saying is totally what I see as well. And I mean, you're seeing it broadly, right? And it makes sense. It really makes sense what you're saying. I mean, when I was talking about, you know, the perception mismatch, I was speaking specifically about the contact tracing stuff. But you're right. It is a bigger issue than that, isn't it? When the perceived privacy risks versus the reality. I mean, I was just explaining a moment ago about how I'm not even really aware of them, right? So how is the average person supposed to be really aware? So the perception of these risks versus where the actual risks are, they don't really line up at all, do they?
No, and understanding is almost like a game of four-dimensional chess because you can come up with an evaluation of the risk right now for a specific use. So do you want to let the health organizations have access to your data so that they can trace this people for this specific use case? But what you don't know is, what are the implications going to be tomorrow? What are the implications going to be in 6 months? What are the implications going to be in 7 years? Because everything is evolving. You know, the way we use data changes.
To be fair, I mean, a lot of this comes down to country-specific stuff. Like here in Australia, there was actually legislation passed for the digital contact tracing stuff where it kind of completely ameliorated the idea of there being a slippery slope. Right? Like this data could only be used for that by punishment of being beaten with a very large stick in the public square if an official misused the data. So that was done in law. So I sort of feel like, and that's been the crazy, okay, so that's been a really crazy thing. We had an app released here. It doesn't really work that well. It doesn't seem to be a privacy horror show, but then you look into the recent Amnesty International report into the apps in places like Qatar and I think it was Norway as well. Some of them were just absolutely terrible. They'd track people's locations. They were full of CVEs. Like they were just really bad. It's been a really uneven experience. And I think the bad experiences have kind of poisoned the concept for people. And all of that happened before Apple and Google could even get the exposure notification API shipped. So it's just like from a perception point of view, from a public perception point of view, I can't think of anything that's a bigger mess right now than the contact tracing stuff, at least in tech.
I think you're absolutely right. But I think there's another aspect to it as well. So the US is taking steps as well. to enshrine what they're doing in law to make sure the data can't be abused. And I imagine most, you know, sensible countries are probably going to take similar steps. But we're talking about one use case that's happening now. What about future use cases? And also, you know, we're talking about implementations that are here now. What about future implementations? The challenge here isn't just the trace together technology, for an, as to name an example. It is the very concept of the fact that you can do this. And we will see other types of technology based on these concepts evolve. And as these concepts come out, they're going to be used for other things. And we have to think about that and almost try to get ahead of it to make sure that we aren't opening a door that is literally Pandora's box.
So what sort of use cases are you concerned about there?
So I think there are some really great possibilities for this to be used for things like law enforcement, but I think there are also some really terrifying cases for this to be used for things like law enforcement. You know, the concept of being able to build a social graph, as you mentioned before.
But isn't that great, though, that Apple and Google saw that risk and have made a technology that completely eliminates that as a possibility? That's why I'm glad that their standard is going to be the de facto standard, so that if there is another pandemic, God forbid, in a few years from now, we will have the technological tool there ready to go, privacy preserving, no social graph, you know, happy days.
I think it is great. And the fact that they have a pretty strong hold on the market means that that implementation is probably going to have good longevity. But, you know, we need to think about the possibility of other implementations being made specifically for those purposes.
But how would people install them? Like, why would people run them?
Because they get told to. There are countries that have, you know, much tougher regimes than ours that are less friendly than ours.
Have we seen an example of that yet, though? Because, I mean, that was one of the concerns early on, right? When this became an issue early on, that was one of the big concerns was, and I think it was Claudio Guarnieri at Amnesty International was saying, you know, and when NSO was sort of lining up to surveil the crap out of everyone on behalf of the Israeli government, like that was, you know, I could sort of see where they were coming from. That was one of his concerns, is that this was kind of a slippery slope towards really intrusive surveillance under the guise of being a public health measure. But we haven't really seen that yet, have we? I mean, I understand what you're saying, which is we need to keep an eye on this. But we haven't seen that yet. And if we do see it, I mean, I'm guessing the places we're likely to see it are places which have already quite a lot of surveillance, places like North Korea, China, places like that. I mean, is that your idea as well, your feeling as well?
Yeah, I think that's broadly where I am. I've seen this happen, though, in other types of technology. One that immediately jumps to mind is the tracking of mobile phone IMSIs. When it came out, you know, IMSI catching was kind of seen as a bit of a fun, gimmicky type thing. It was identified as a security risk, but no one really took it very seriously. But as soon as it became obvious that it could be used to track people in a relatively easy way, it became a blooming industry. And now IMSI catchers have seen worldwide deployment in almost every country, including most Western countries, because the ability to track people is very useful.
But it's also a great way to get an idea of, like, you know, a list of everyone who attended a protest, for example. I mean, that's the big problem with those things.
And what could be better than do that than to do it through contact tracing and also identify all the people they go into contact with afterwards?
But that's my point. You can't do that with the exposure notification API, which is why I'm such a fan of it.
Yeah, but my point, I try to think like as many steps ahead as I can.
Yeah.
And I think we need to be thinking about these use cases coming up and look at how, if at all, we want them to happen. And if we want them to happen, we need to start preparing the conversations and the necessary legal frameworks to do it properly. And if we don't want them to happen, we need to do the same.
Yeah, no. I think you're absolutely right. I do. And I've got to ask, I mean, this isn't something that's really come up in the show because it's more privacy oriented, But, you know, we give Apple a bit of shit, actually, for their completely over-the-top hostile attitude towards law enforcement and refusal to work on things like unlocking, you know, iPhones of dead terrorists and stuff. We think that's dumb. But at the same time, their commitment to privacy and actually doing things in a completely different way for users is really commendable. I don't know if you've had a chance to actually take a look at the new features in iOS 14 when it comes to, you know, app tracking and stuff like that. Like,
yep.
They're really doing some remarkable stuff. And it feels like if users start to expect and demand these types of features, other companies will have to follow suit. How much of a big deal do you think iOS 14 is for privacy writ large?
Well, I mean, I think it's a big enough deal. The Forbes headline was something like Apple kills $80 billion industry the changes to the tracking identifiers are literally just going to upend the entire mobile marketing industry and how you understand the way people interact with the apps on their iOS-based smartphones.
I mean, it just feels like they've finally realized, like, people at Apple have gone, okay, this has gone too far. Let's crush it.
Yeah, I think so. And I wait to see what happens next because, you know, marketing often always finds a way. And there is a need for some of this kind of data collection. What I hope is we can use this time to create frameworks in which this is done responsibly so that people's digital identities can be protected and understood better. Because most people will happily pick up an app and use it regardless of what the marketing implications are or the data exhaust that's being used because they want to use the app. And so they see it. They don't even think about the trade-off. They just use it.
Yeah. You know, so I'm guilty of that myself, you know?
So you see things like FaceApp appear and people talk about it. And the only reason anyone kicks up a massive fuss is because it's a Russian app. When the reality is there's like a dozen Western apps that are doing similar things that have even unfriendlier EULAs and nobody's really talking about it because they're not Russian. The fact is, you know, we need to look at our data and our online identities as a whole because they're going to become increasingly important. As security moves much more to a contextual kind of basis, those little pieces of contextual information are going to become like gold.
Yeah, I'm guessing a lot of Okta's concern about this is that you do profile devices and people as part of the sort of authentication process, and maybe you've taken a look at how easy that is, and that's a bit concerning.
It's a little bit of that. I mean, we obviously do a ton of analysis of devices and behaviors and things like that. But there's also a very big kind of drive within Okta and within a lot of the communities that we work with to do the responsible thing with online data. We're all tech consumers as well. And I don't like the idea that somebody can go and build a profile on me by working as a man in the middle between some supply chain elements and then go and sell that profile to another organization that they can then make decisions about.
No, you're right. It's
that
creepy
makes me
as
uncomfortable.
Hell. It's creepy as hell. It makes me uncomfortable as well. I got no idea what marketers know about me. But look, we're going to have to wrap it up there. We're out of time. It's been a real pleasure, Mark Rogers, to chat with you and we'll look forward to having you on the show again. Cheers.
Always a pleasure.
That was Mark Rogers there. Big thanks to him for that. And yeah, don't forget SSO and identity tech like Okta is the way everything's moving. So if you are not familiar with their tech yet, go check them out at okta.com. And big thanks to them for being a sponsor this week. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back tomorrow with a 45-minute podcast all about business email compromise. That one's brought to you by Proofpoint. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.